I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hi everyone, welcome to Dinosaurs History here. We've got the last in our little mini-series, our little strand of legends, stars in the firmament of the historical pantheon, galaxy, starscape, sky at night. Anyway, here is Mary Beard. We saved the best till last. We've had Eric Foner, go back and check that out. We had Michael Wood, both really wonderful conversations. This conversation with Mary took place a couple of years ago. This is a rerun episode. Professor Mary Beard at Cambridge University is obviously a legend. She is pretty much the most famous historian broadcaster in the UK. Her fame has spread across the world. She's a classicist. She engages robustly on contemporary issues. She is a total legend. I went round to her house. We drank a lot of wine. She put me right, fairly politely, on lots of things. And I was just given a glorious glimpse into what it must be like to be taught by her. She is a national treasure, and it was a great pleasure to have her on the podcast. This episode was hugely popular the first time it went out. I hope the rest of you who've joined this podcast journey subsequently enjoy it. If you want to listen to all the back episodes of this podcast without advertisements on the front, then you can do so at History Hit TV. It's also like a history channel. It's also basically the Netflix for history. You've got all the audio on there. Got all the video, including the Christmas Truce, now the most watched programme in the history of History Hit TV. I should make a history podcast about the history of that another time. And you can do so at a special introductory rate. It's the January sale at the moment, everyone. You can use the code January, and then you get a month for free, and then your first 3 months for 80% off, which is a sweet deal. So go and check that out. Listen to Mary Beard, then go and check that out. It's going to get you through these long winter months. We're going to get to the vaccine, everyone. And we're going to get you to the vaccine with very, very cheap access to History at TV. In the meantime, before you go and do that, this is Professor Mary Beard. Enjoy. Mary Beard, thank you so much for talking to me.
It's a real pleasure.
Well, thanks. Now, why on earth does the ancient world continue to matter to us today?
Well, that's the 64,000.
That's a big question. But come on, let's just get straight into it.
Now, and if you look at the media, the ordinary print online media, you'd think it mattered to us because there were lessons that we could learn in ancient Rome, that we could think,
Republic turns into empire, it's all happening.
President Trump exactly. Is like Caligula, and somehow the job of the historian is to kind of match up ancient Rome and its lessons with modern politics and, in a sense, a prognostication. Now, I think that's charming, sweet and fun, and I do it all the time. But I think more to the point is that what the ancient world does is that it helps us think harder about us. We don't learn lessons from it, people used to say, and it was deeply embarrassing, had we known what a rough time the Romans had Iraq, we would never have gone there. And I thought, well, there's millions of other reasons not to go to Iraq. We don't need to know about Trajan's problems. This is kind of passing the buck, really. But I think what Romans do is that they They help us see some of our problems from the outside. They help us look at things in a different way. They help us think about actually the basic kind of ground rules of modern, Western, liberal, I suppose, liberal culture. They say, right, okay, what does citizenship mean? Now, Romans had a very different view of citizenship from us. We don't need to follow it. But it makes us say to ourselves, look, there's another way of looking at things. I mean, I always remember, because I was brought up with this, you know, on the Norman Tebbit cricket test. You know, so they're those kind of damn immigrants. And what you need to do is you need to go to the cricket match and you need to see whether they're supporting India or England. And I think the real point is the Romans had a completely different version of that. They knew that you could be a citizen of two places. You could be a citizen of Arpinum in Italy, of Aphrodisias in what we would call Turkey, and a citizen of Rome. And that there wasn't a conflict. Now, we might argue with them about the conflict, but actually they do kind of turn the question back on us and just say, why are we so certain about how we do what we do?
So history is about calling out bullshit. It's about questioning certainty.
I don't know about bullshit. I think people use bullshit in a terrible way, actually. But it means usually what I don't agree with. But I think that history is about... it's about challenging certainty. It's about helping you to see yourself in a different guise, to see yourself from the outside. So history is about the past, but it's also about imagining how you would look from the future. So, you know, one of the things it does is it teaches us to see, in my case, you know, what seems so odd about the Romans. But it also helps you see what will seem so odd about us in 100 years, 200 years. You know, what will students, when they're doing the history of Britain in the 21st century, what will they be writing about?
I can take a few guesses. in that case, but why Rome then? I mean, would this be true, I suppose it would be, if you were studying the Angevin Empire?
In some ways it's true of anything. In some ways, getting outside your box and becoming a kind of anthropologist of other cultures and yourself, every which one works. I think why Rome and Greece, but particularly Rome, matters so much, is that Rome is not only another culture, which it is, weird, strange, horrible, don't want to go there, but it's also a culture through which our forebears from 19th, 18th, 17th century, they have learnt to think. We learnt to think about politics, about right and wrong, about the problems of being a human being, about what it was to be good, about what it was to be, you know, proper, you know, in the forum or in bed, whatever. We learnt that from Rome. Of course, we adjusted it, we renegotiated it. But so Rome is a kind of a brilliant paradigm for us because it's both utterly different and it makes us kind of think about real difference. And yet it's a culture which has somehow said, this is how you learn about what liberty is. This is how you learn about what the rights of the citizen is. So we are both an interlocutor with Rome. We're both happily much better than ancient Rome, and we're also the descendants of ancient Rome.
That's brilliant. But what strikes me about your programmes that you do so well is you call Rome a weird culture, and yet in your programmes you're so famous for pointing out domestic objects, practices, ways of living that makes those intervening centuries disappear and stress our common humanity.
Yeah, I think it's great fun. You know, I think it's really important. I mean, if Rome was just weird, Why would we be interested? You know, if we happen to know that there were men on Mars and they did things differently, well, you know, fine, I'd be mildly interested, but so what? But what's interesting about Rome is that they do things differently and are simultaneously completely familiar. And yet, in that familiarity, they do things differently. I mean, I think one of the things we do on the telly programmes, you know, and maybe it's a cheap trick, but, you know, wherever we go to the local Roman lavatories.
Obviously.
You know, of course you do. And, you know, I think people do think, cheap trick, you know, it's easy to say, oh, this is where Romans, you know, sat and chat or whatever. But there's no better place for saying, so where does the difference between us and them become clear? And there's no better place for getting, particularly kids, to say, okay, I can begin to kind of engage in this history. You know, how did they sit here? You know, do you think they kind of wiped their bottoms? Did they stand up? Did they sit down? And you start to see in those rather kind of, often rather over posh and probably very restored Roman lavatories, as far apart as, you know, Timgad in Algeria and Ostia in Italy, you start to see a little problem about how you reconstruct Roman life, how you reconstruct what the rules were. And we don't know whether these lavatories, you know, all lined up in a row, was it unisex? Was it blokes only? We don't know about standing up, sitting down. We don't know about what the kind of, I don't know what the currently what the conventions are in a male urinal.
You don't want to know. You don't want to know.
People tell me that you don't talk to the person you next don't. To you, but I always imagine that you do.
It'd be much nicer if you did.
But when you come down to basics, you know, you don't need to know a whole lot of technical detail about the past. You can actually make it sing for you by thinking, what was it like for someone to be there and how could I reconstruct that experience?
Where do you find the past is most real to you? When you're sitting in this beautiful room looking at your copy of Tacitus, or when you're sitting amongst an archaeological ruin in Portus on the coast of Italy?
Well, they're both real, aren't they? I mean, I think that the past speaks to you, and you have to keep it in a way in its place, right? I think one of the jobs of the historian is to keep the past in its place. But it speaks to you in a very different way. And I think that, you know, there are some bits of ancient literature I've read that have always made me rethink who I was. And rethink my politics. And I think the obvious example is, you know, Tacitus. He's ventriloquizing a defeated person in South Scotland, looking at what the impact of Roman rule is and saying, they make a desert and they call it peace. There has never, ever been a more pithy summation of what military conquest is.
And particularly in the 20th century of industrial warfare, it became truer than ever. It's amazing.
Tacitus will be smiling in his grave because he showed us just what warfare and peacemaking, you know, what the underbelly was. And I remember I first read that when I was at school, and I was doing Latin at school, Greek at school. I was a bit of a kind of bolshy little teenager.
Don't believe that.
No. True. And I remember suddenly thinking, these Romans are speaking to me. You know, making a desert and calling it peace. You know, that's going to go on my tombstone, I think. And so I think, you know, there are bits of Roman literature which are so, not just moving, but they're so to the point, they're so politically acute, that you can't ignore them. But also, I think the fun that I have is sort of putting that together with the day-to-day, the ordinary. You know, because most of the people we read about in Roman literature are so damn, you know, upper class, right? And if you say, okay, let's think about what ordinary life is like. What's great about going around Roman sites, whether it's in Housesteads on Hadrian's Wall or Timgad in Algeria, is you start to see the real life of whether it's the Roman squaddy or the Roman civilian, and you start to kind of raise the other issues about how it was to exist in that world that we don't think about.
Well, it's so funny you say it, because I've always been fascinated, as a total amateur in Roman history, why you read Suetonius and the court historians, and they are describing a kind of litany of insanity and misrule and hedonism and all the rest of it. And yet, of course, there's this fact, which is, despite civil wars and occasional major foreign incursions, the empire survives. Longevity is, everyone's interested in longevity. So when you're looking at the difference between the source and then when you go on the ground, what has that told you about the relationship between the imperial centre and these, the real life of these Romans on around the periphery?
Well, that's a really good question.
Right, my work here is done.
That's really good question. Thanks, Dan. And that's the question, because, you know, one of the big issues about thinking about the Roman Empire is how did the guy in the middle, or the guy in the middle with his advisors, how did they actually control anything? Well, you know, they could send a letter to what is now Turkey, and it would take a couple of months to get there, by which time presumably any crisis was over. And so you start to think that this is a, you know, this, what is it like to live in a world of not rapid communications but also of autocracy? And there are clearly big things that happen. You know, Emperor Hadrian travels the empire. You know, he goes around. He meets people. He rather prefers the east to the west and the north, but he goes around and he makes his mark, and he gives a vision of what it is to be a Roman emperor visiting the community. Mostly, it can't have been like that. Mostly, it was guys learning how to use the new lavatories that had been just set up in their local town, really new, because, you know, they're sort of running water. And their relationship with Roman power is, you know, at the very least, it's mediated by the big guys in the local community, the lower officials in the Roman administration. You know, and Rome works because it, in a sense, because it leaves people alone, I suppose.
So the local elites, it's the accommodation with the local elites is fundamental to understanding the empire.
Yeah, if you're going to do the big structural analysis of why the Roman Empire works, you know, given it has, you know, it has very few officials on the ground, very few troops, really, compared with the size of the local population. I mean, it makes the British Empire look overstaffed, right? Then the only way you can see that it works is by collaboration. So it collaborates with the local elites. The local elites do its dirty work. The peasant just knows he's paying tax to someone, but it doesn't much matter whether it's the Romans or the last guy who is asking for tax. And the Roman elite, the local elites are, in a sense, drawn in by the excitement of being part of the imperial project. Now, we don't know how that works on the ground. I mean, Tacitus is very cynical about it. You know, he looks at Britain and says, ha, ha, ha. You know, so they all like the idea of baths and togas, ho, 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 just another facet of their enslavement.
But there were examples of elite Syrians, Brits, rising quite high in imperial hierarchies, enjoying patronage. I mean, so that might, it did work on one level, didn't it? despite Tastus being rude about it.
Yeah, Tastus saw the soft underbelly of it. I mean, I think that the only way it works is that they incorporate the outsider. And so we have a model of empire which is very top-down. Now, in some ways, structurally, I guess every empire is top-down. But Romans made, whether this was consciously or not, they made the upper echelons of the oppressed feel that they could get to be on the top. And so you see, you get Roman emperors in the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD who are born elsewhere. You know, they're not people who think of themselves as Roman in terms of coming from Italy. So it's an incorporative empire. Now, in some ways, I think that's probably as nasty. You know, maybe it's as nasty an empire as any empire, but it's still a different version from ours.
What about the dysfunction in the imperial centre? Does that have less an impact because you've got these quite stable elites around the periphery? Or is the imperial centre less dysfunctional than we've all come to believe?
I don't know how we know how dysfunctional the imperial centre was. You know, if you were to read about the centre of British politics, in the second half of 2017, mm-hmm. you would think that it was entirely dysfunctional. And we know that if we were to look at this with a longer viewpoint, we would partly think, yes, it was. But we'd also think that probably Britain has managed quite well for hundreds of years with a dysfunctional centre. We also think that the kind of crises that for us mean dysfunction, probably conceal the fact that there is a perfectly decent system kind of trundling on.
Exactly. Humming away beneath the bonnet.
It's humming away, And I think there is... We can't see that in Rome. You can go look at what you know about the imperial bureaucracy. And it's hard to say, aha, that's the civil service. But somewhere under there is an imperial bureaucracy humming along.
You're listening to History Hit with Mary Beard, more coming up after this.
How did Hitler's sexuality shape his worldview? Why did the Black Death lead to the rise of the witch trials? And what are some of the sauciest scandals involving kings and queens at Hampton Court? I don't know about you, but this is the history I want to hear about. If you do too, then join me, Kate Lister, every Tuesday and Friday to find out the answers to all of these questions and more. Listen to Betwixt the Sheets, the History of Sex Scandal in Society, wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you use a messaging app, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, Add unlimited photos and videos and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's A-U-R-A frames.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Talking about an incorporative empire, you've got in a lot of trouble recently, Mary. For talking about multiculturalism and parallels with Rome and the Roman world. I mean, is this an empire in which people had equal access? Would Rome have felt like New York today with a different colour? I mean, it's a thorny issue.
Look, you know, Rome would not have felt quite like, you know, I'm not sure I should talk about what New York today feels like, because I think it probably feels quite exclusionary to some people in New York today, you know, who have no rights to work. So I think, there's a problem about, there's always a problem about this kind of, you know, the dream of the open society. But I think what's important about Rome is it is desire and its commitment to incorporate those that it conquers. Now, that doesn't mean that we think that conquest was nice, but Rome's distinction is its follow through, and it follows through. It follows that through, both in myth and in reality. So, you know, if you're a Roman, you say, "Where do we come from? Where are we Romans come from?" Well, actually, we Romans, by the way, we're refugees. You know, we came from Troy. You know, there was Aeneas, he was a refugee from war-torn Troy, and he founded a race, he didn't actually found Rome, but he founded the Roman race here in Italy. So their origin myth is one of the incorporation of outsiders. That's the same is almost true with Romulus, who actually founded the city. You know, he was sort of the Roman race, but what does he do? He kills his brother, he puts up a notice because he's got a new city and he hasn't got any citizens. He says, "Refugees, welcome." Right? Now, that is an extraordinary myth of origin in terms of how the ancient world sees this and how we see it, actually. And it's absolutely hardwired into the way Romans think about themselves. But you see that, because they invented that myth, it wasn't true. You see that in terms of many of the things that the other people in the ancient world thought was odd about them. So, for example, when a Roman citizen frees a slave, as they did much more often, it seems, than other slave-owning societies in the ancient world. That slave who is freed becomes a Roman citizen. So there is a kind of absolute kind of feedback loop from the foreign, because originally most slaves are foreign, from the foreign into the idea of Roman citizenship. Now, we have a very, very ethnocentric view of citizenship. And I don't think that, it's not, it would be mad to say we can just look at the Romans and do it their way. Yeah, we're different. But it is important, I think, to say, look, there is another community which in the past, hugely successful empire, whatever you mean by successful, who actually worked on different principles from us. It doesn't say, "I want you away from here, all you outsiders." It says, "We're going to take you in."
I also want to talk about women, because you've been doing a lot of work recently about women. I'm really struck by every time I enter, I'm a generalist, so every time I discover a new period and I talk to new historian specialists, and I read wonderful new books, they go, "This period is very unusual in that there's some very powerful women behind the scenes pulling the strings." And it seems to me that just happens time and time again. So have women actually been completely excluded from governance, and with a few exceptions, or has traditional tellings of history deliberately ignored or been unable to recognise the role that women have played in wielding real power?
It's sort of both of those I guess. And every historian of every different culture always claims a particularly interesting role for their own women.
Exactly.
You know, but, you know, actually, get real, I suppose I say. And, you know, I don't want to be told that women in my period, wielded power behind the scenes. You know, that's what they always say. And I'm much more interested in the women of no doubt talent, intelligence, flair, whatever, of how they were put down. You know, and I think there are many, many ways of putting women down throughout history. And I think that also there are ways, and those are the ways, in which we still learn to put women down. I mean, I don't look back to the ancient world for role models of how women can be successful. You know, I think, I'd be mad. You know, gobby women got shut up in the period that I'm interested. But I'm looking at the ways in which that was part of ancient culture, and also in the ways that we have, in some senses, inherited, largely indirectly but partly directly, our view of women's exclusion from the public sphere from them.
Why has women's exclusion been so persistent? Big question.
Dan, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be really, really famous, popular,
even more famous.
Right, okay. But what I can tell you, I can't answer that question, but I can say there are ways in which our own exclusion of women from the public sphere both pick up on and match and reprocess the exclusion of women from the public sphere in Western culture that has gone for 2,000 years. And one of the things that very, very much struck me recently was looking at the Clinton-Trump election campaign. And there were Trump souvenirs which portrayed actually a replay of the myth of the hero Perseus cutting off the head of the snaky locked Gorgon Medusa, and so in a sense kind of proving his manly worth. What they did was that they picked up Cellini's sculpture of Perseus Medusa, still on display in Florence, in the, you know, the Piazza della Signoria, and what they did was they put Trump's face onto Perseus, the heroic murderer, as we say, and the bleeding, nasty, gunge-oozing head of Medusa had Hillary Clinton's face. And at that, I thought, just said, look, in the end, the clash, the gender clash between men and women, violently played out in the ancient world, is still a gender clash that we replay. Right? Now, this is and worse than that, I think, that this was something you could buy this image on, you know, on tote bags, on computer folders, on coffee cups, on T-shirts. And the idea that somehow still we were buying into the decapitation of a powerful woman with her snaky locks. And the same goes for Theresa May, it goes for Angela Merkel, it goes for any other woman, you know, in power. They're always represented as that awful, disruptive, dangerous, turn you to stone woman that's Medusa. We're still doing it. Now, I thought it was very interesting because, you know, just after Trump had come to power, there was a bit of a, you know, minor storm in a teacup. You know, when a comedian I thought in rather bad taste, actually, holds up on television, you know, a head of a decapitated Trump. And I thought, you know, not that, you know, I don't want to do that, it's not nice. She loses her job. The comedian loses her job. The previous 18 months, we had seen images of a decapitated Hillary Clinton as kind of souvenirs. Now, if you want to say, where does the ancient world lie in our sensibilities, it lies right there, actually.
Can you explain why the Romans created and built that trope? So, because actually the Romans faced, and there's lots of interesting women in the Roman period.
There's always lots of interesting women.
And why were they uniquely stigmatized and turned into? Some of Rome's most famous enemies were these women.
Roman patriarchal culture, like every patriarchal culture, both fights and invents the danger of women. How do you justify patriarchy? Because I think that, you know, many individuals within patriarchy are extremely anxious about what it's standing for. You invent the justification of patriarchy by inventing the danger of women. Women have to be dangerous. You have to show everybody that if you turn your back, the women will take over and wreck things. They'll make a mess of it. Right? So Greek literature particularly, and it's taken over in many respects by the Romans. You know, Greek literature is full of women who are about to kill you, you know, are about to go mad. You know, there's, you know, the Amazons, you know, the mythical race of warrior women on the margins who, you know, it is the job of every good Greek boy to stop, you know, I kill. You have glimpses in all kinds of Greek tragic drama of what is going to happen if women get in control, you know. So Clytemnestra is left alone when Agamemnon goes off to the Trojan War. You know, he happens to actually sacrifice their daughter in the run-up to this. What bad news.
Takes up all these slave girls.
But, you know, he comes back and what has Clytemnestra done? She has taken over the state and then she kills him. You know, so there is no way of being a powerful woman in antiquity, in any public sense, who is not somehow undermined by the threat of death, or in a sense, a collapse of civilized values as we know it. And you know, there are marvelous stories, even about, you know, poor women who just get up to speak in the Roman Forum because they want to say something, and their words will be reported as she barked and yapped. You know, that somehow women don't talk in male language, they don't get listened to, but they're always dangerous dogs. Women are dangerous dogs.
What's interesting about you, Mary Beard, is that you say that history needs to be kept distinct. You say it's not for our time. And you say there are no lessons. And yet you spend a lot of time talking about the present when we're talking about history.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Dan. And I think that, for me, what I dislike about the use of Roman history is the kind of the matching up scenario, we shouldn't do this because the Romans got it wrong. That's stupid. But actually, you know, why I think one of the reasons that it's still worth studying the ancient world is because, you know, we're still talking to it. We're still learning from it. We're still actually kind of, you know, negotiating our position in relation to antiquity. And so you can say that you're not interested in the ancient world, but nobody living in this country can escape the ancient world. You can't get rid of it. You know, you can't get rid of it because it's filling your bloody teacups. if you're in the United States. You know, it's still defining how we think about women. You know, one of the things I was, you know, both pleased and sad to share with people quite recently was, you know, you go to the Odyssey, probably the second work of ancient literature, the second work of Western literature ever written. You know, you're in book one of the Odyssey. It's the story of, you know, Odysseus been in the Trojan War. He's got to get back to Penelope, and he's got a hell of a lot of difficulties getting back to his lovely wife. And, you know, how is this going to happen? And the first book zooms down into Odysseus's palace. He's still trying to get back home. And there's Penelope, and she's got loads and loads of guys who want to marry her. It's a real pain. And at one point, and I think it's an absolutely formative moment in Western culture, soon into the first book of the Odyssey, her young son, a rather whip behind the ears teenager, is there. Penelope comes down. She's been doing women's stuff upstairs, and she comes down. There's all these kind of guys who want to marry her, and there's a bard, and he is sort of strumming on his lyre, and he's saying, and he's kind of telling, singing a song about how awful it is for the Trojan, the Greek heroes to get back from the Trojan War, come back, back home. It's terribly depressing. So Penelope says, excuse me, I would really rather you sang a rather more cheerful number, actually. You know? Perfectly reasonable request. Telemachus, this wet behind the ears teenager, says, shut up. Speech, public speech, is for men. Get back upstairs, Mum. Now, if you wanted a kind of a symbolic start of Western culture's erasure of the voice of women, you don't need to look further than, you know, than one of the very first works of Western literature in which teenager, slightly not yet grown up, says to savvy middle-aged woman, stop talking, speech is man's business, it's my business, upstairs to your loom. And I think, to some extent, you know, I've been very lucky. No, it would be wrong of me to say that I have been deprived of voice.
You have not been stuck to your loom.
I have not been stuck to my loom, and I've been very lucky. But I think that that basic idea that you don't hear what women say is still something that that sticks. You know, and when people, you know, like on things like, you know, how many people of colour there were in Roman Britain, you know, right to me, so, you stupid, you know, then, you know, put any kind of noun in there that you like, you know, you just, you know, don't, you know, you're just silly, you don't understand this. You know, they're doing the Telemachus number. They're saying, shut up, woman, get back to what you understand, knitting.
Always struck by Twitter when you get into your periodic fight with the rest of the world, and the people will tell men that they disagree with them, and they'll be very rude about the opinion. See, you know, but then with you, they make it immediately about you as a person.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And I think it's, I think there's a very interesting sense here that men are allowed to have wrong views. You know, in the public sphere, men are allowed to have wrong views. Just to say things that they regret, that are wrong, and they're, you know, they're, and they're told that what they said there was wrong. Women are told that, A, they're not allowed a voice, so, you know, I'm going to cut your head off and rape it, you know? So don't speak again, darling. Or they are stupid. You know, not that we happen to disagree, they are stupid. And I think that that's, you know, that came out, I think, very, very clearly around the election campaign in the different treatment of Diane Abbott and Boris Johnson, who both got it wrong, terribly wrong in radio interviews. You know, Abbott, you know, couldn't even begin to compute the cost of the new policing policy, and Johnson didn't seem to know a thing about the party's you know, key aims in the post-manifesto world. You know, Abbott is treated as if somehow, you know, she's just not up to it. And Boris is just wrapped over the knuckles and told to, you know, oh, come on, Boris, get a grip. Now, you know, nobody tells me to get a grip. They tell me I am stupid.
Are you going to leave this world? I mean, if you've got, it's a bit depressing because you've got 2,800 years since the Odyssey of culture to contend with. Are you confident you're going to leave the next generation in a better place than where you found it?
Absolutely. I mean, look, when I, and this is thinking very in very parochial terms, but you know, when I came to the University of Cambridge as an undergraduate, there were about 12% women. Were undergraduates. And that's now almost 50%. You know, that's 50 years. And I think, you know, I think it's really important that women go on fighting all this stuff and saying, you know, come on, you know, there's more to be done here. But also, they do need to take a bit of time off to say, we've done, you know, a huge amount. My mum was born before women had a vote in parliamentary elections. You know, that's one generation. So, yeah, I think at the same time as one goes on and on battling, one also ought to kind of raise a glass, as I'm about to do, to, you know, the successes that we've had. You know, there has been in my lifetime a revolution and, you know, I'm a beneficiary of it.
Can you pass me a glass? Oh, do you mind if I... Well, I've been a beneficiary of it too. Thank you so much, Mary.
We're all a beneficiary. When the talents of women are exploited, we all benefit.
Hope you enjoyed the podcast. Just before you go, bit of a favour to ask. I totally understand if you don't want to become a subscriber or pay me any cash money. Makes sense. But if you could just do me a favour, it's for free. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. If you give it a 5-star rating and give it an absolutely glowing review, purge yourself, give it a glowing review. I'd really appreciate that. It's a tough world out there. Law of the jungle out there. And I need all the fire support I can get. So that will boost it up the charts. It's so tiresome. But if you could do it, I'd be very, very grateful. Thank you.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.